My film and fiction students just finished watching It's a Wonderful Life this week. I love showing them something I'm not sure they would normally choose to watch. We watch movies from multiple decades and genres to give them a solid background on where things come from sometimes when it comes to pop culture, fashion, food, sayings, and traditions. I try to give them a backstory and share information that lends itself to the tale. Some of them have had some tough times. I want them to know it will get better. The stories become part of who we are and who we are meant to be. This year we finished the movie on my son's dad's birthday. I spent 10 years married to a man who embraced this story and all of its layers. I can't think of George Bailey without thinking of Dave McCulley. We lost him to a sudden illness last Christmas, and the story rings more true to me today than ever before. He had wanted us to have a big party, so we did just that and had him one, right before that big winter storm blew in. We lost my mom at Christmas in 2007. She loved Christmas, so we forced ourselves to celebrate. Holidays are sentimental and are often full of memories that conjure up a multitude of emotions. Celebrations can become bittersweet. Holidays are just joyous and tough at the same time, and you know what? That's okay. Our 1946 Frank Capra classic stars Jimmy Stewart as George Bailey. George is down on his luck on Christmas Eve as his foggy-brained uncle has misplaced $8,000 of the bank's money in Bedford Falls. George thinks he might be going to jail. He is worried that his life has become one big disappointment for his family and friends. The story of George's life unfolds as a bit of a historical time capsule as we see his hometown, family, and friends from when George saves his brother in a World War I era ice skating accident that results in damaged hearing for George, who will later be unable to serve his own country in World War II. We see how George and his wife Mary quickly use their honeymoon funds to keep the bank's doors open as the stock market crashes and causes the Great Depression. They are able to offer their community hope amidst dark times with their paltry funds. His brother Harry gets to become the highly decorated war hero years later, while his friend Sam Wainwright, hee-haw, gets to be a successful and wealthy businessman in the city. George's story seems to wrap itself around a life of continuous sacrifice and selfless devotion to his town, his family, and his friends. It is also full of disappointments and heartbreaks. He ultimately realizes the depths of what he has given up and considers suicide, but opts to jump in the water to save his angel, Clarence Oddbody, who is trying hard to get his wings by saving George. George jumps off the bridge to save Clarence, which ironically ends up as Clarence saving George, after George gets a glimpse of what life would have been like without him in Bedford Falls. Things would have been totally different, and not in a good way. Clarence, a reading angel, is reading The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. Make no mistake, the story is essentially anchored in Tom Sawyer, which teaches us about the magic of childhood and how important it is to have a sense of adventure when life throws you some curveballs. It also teaches you about friendship. Ironically, Jimmy Stewart and I have a connection. His grandpa, Colonel Samuel McCartney Jackson of the 11th Pennsylvania Reserves, was at the Battle of Gettysburg during the Civil War. He survived that battle. My great-great-great-grandfather, 1st Lieutenant Russell Woodward Legg, fought for the 50th Virginia Infantry at Gettysburg and would later be captured at the courthouse in Spotsylvania, Pennsylvania. Ultimately, he became part of the Confederates' Immortal 600 at Fort Pulaski, and his remains are buried and marked at that location, along with at least a dozen others. The Immortal 600 refused to take an oath and were in turn starved and used as human shields. Stewart's grandfather would go on to have a daughter, who would in turn have a son named Jimmy Stewart. My ancestor would not survive that war, but he had already sired the man whose lineage would make up my own. Stewart would become the first major American movie star to enlist in the United States Army during World War II. The story seems to send a message to George Bailey and us that his angel is there to save him, back to the movie. However, the story has more layers than that. I think the story tells us the people and the community that he has spent his life devoted to literally saved him. I can identify with George. When push came to shove, they all pulled together to replace that $8,000 that Mr. Potter, the villain of the tale, had in his possession. The story ends with Clarence getting his wings, the community coming together, and George Bailey realizing how rich he really is after all. I have some friends, family members, and students going through some tough times. Ironically, a colleague of mine turned 40 this week. I was thinking that while Sam Percival was letting out his first cries in December of 1983, I was encountering my own George Bailey moment. There have been several. And here we are, 40 years later, both of us going strong. My dad had died in 1983 and was only 60 years old, a couple of years younger than I am now. I was 2 years into a marriage that included some layoffs, tuition hikes and schooling, and unexpected car troubles, just to name a few of the things we were challenged with at that time. A regional newspaper had even visited us to do a story on how a local couple dealt with poverty and drastic life changes. It indicated that we were living on love. I guess that was true. I finally found a job I loved at a nearby newspaper when, out of the blue, new owners stepped forward on Christmas Eve in the middle of a party where I was in charge of the games. Excited about my Christmas ham that I had tucked in the floorboard of my 1975 Volkswagen Rabbit, I soon discovered that the new owner's thing meant I would be out of a job. My office was needed to make room for the new guy. This would be my third layoff in 2 years, as the economy in the 1980s was less than stellar. I asked more than once that day if I could just stay for the party and not be on the clock. That was allowed, but I must have been having too much fun, I guess, because soon they sent me packing after two or three visits, and I was trudging through the bitter temperatures and snow to my car, which made an ugly sound every single time I tried to get the ignition to turn over. I went back to the building, pounded on the front door to make a phone call, and saw where my office was already being rearranged. Such is life. My husband and brother-in-law came to my rescue and worked some kind of mechanic magic with the car. Soon we were headed back to Aurora to celebrate Christmas Eve and Christmas Day at my brother's house on West Hadley Street. I had some wrapping to finish, and I had even made a bunch of my own gifts that year. I was determined to make the best of things and make it through the holidays. At some point on the edge of town, my sobbing had subsided, and David McCulley said to me, "Hey, I don't want to scare you, but I think we're on fire." I looked up, gasped in horror. The hood of that yellow Volkswagen Rabbit was a big, boiling bubble of what looked like molten lava. I let out a scream and grabbed for the door. I opened the door and began to dive out of the car. David grabbed my britches and a scuffle ensued. It wasn't pretty. I had a huge fear of burning up in something after all of the fires I had covered through the years. I broke loose, jumped out of the car, and rolled and bounced across Highway 39 near my church, Fellowship Baptist, as David tried to guide the car towards the ditch. What kept me from getting run over is beyond me to this day. I managed to grab a crowbar from a passing motorist and rescued my Christmas ham with a loud crunch to the back window. I was not going to walk away empty-handed. If you have ever wondered if there were any metal parts in a Volkswagen Rabbit, worry no more. 90% of that vehicle converged into a big black blob of coal that the firefighters promptly delivered to my house on West College Street. It rested atop a new blue tarp in my backyard until we bribed someone into hauling it off. In the hours ahead, my insurance agent would insist that I drive the car to his business so he could take a look. I kept insisting to him it was not drivable. Then, when I received my insurance check, a salesman at Mitchell's tried to get me to test drive a Chevy Nova with no seat. Well, I say it had no seat, but it had a peach basket turned upside down with a rug tossed on top. This was before the law changed about selling vehicles with no seats. I had already lost a ton of my dignity in a short period of time, it seems. I refused to sit on the basket, had big words with my polite mother, and drove to Mays, where I purchased a 1975 Pontiac Granville Brougham. It had the word ham in it, and I was sold. It had velvet seats, power locks, push-button accessories, and a white crocodile top. The body was a metallic orange rust. The car itself was longer than my house. You should Google it if you doubt me. But I digress. I would love to have another one of these vehicles if anyone has one just laying around. You could live in that thing. A kind lady stopped on the side of the road and offered me a job at another newspaper the coming week. Word had traveled fast, it seems. That newspaper would have paved the way for me to become news editor at the Monat Times and eventually return as managing editor at the Aurora Advertiser, a place that always owns a piece of my heart, especially at Christmas. My brother had to come and get me Christmas morning in his little black truck. He gave me a pep talk about the value of hard times during the few blocks we traveled to his house. My husband got called to work emergency for the railroad that weekend, which he loved. I remember being a little lonesome, but glad at the same time. I got to snuggle up with Christmas leftovers, a good book, a scented candle, and my ham. I made a bucket list of where I saw myself in the next 5 years. I would knock out most of that list in less than 4. Little did I know that a few more hard times awaited us, with a couple of accidents, a lawsuit, the loss of a close friend, and the loss of my grandpa. But you know, that is just how life is. You have to take in all of it to figure out what truly matters. What are the lessons learned from that 1983 Christmas crisis? Well, number one, ham makes everything better. Everything. It's even worth a few asphalt burns, I guess. Number two, tenacity, grit, and resourcefulness isn't for sissies. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Just don't quit. Finish everything. Number three, a woman with a crowbar in her hands is a powerful thing, especially when she is wielding it like a banshee across a snow-covered roadway. Number four, wedgies only hurt for a little while. I told you he grabbed my britches and refused to let go. Number five, don't spend your life worrying about the worst that can happen, because even when the worst happens, you find out who you are. Get back up, dust yourself off, sing a little Christmas song. You'll feel better. Number six, all roads really do lead home. Seven, if you have faith, family, friends, and a community that loves you, you really are rich after all. Number eight, why, it really is a wonderful life. George Bailey was right. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.